Welcome back to Paths to Purpose. We are back this week with another special guest, Dr. Laura Britton Steele, or Dr. B, as Mikey affectionately calls her. And Mikey, we are really excited to have you on today as well in this little intro to introduce Dr. B. Can you tell us how you met Dr. B and why you wanted to have her on Paths to Purpose?
Yeah, so hi, I'm Mikey. I am a student at Ithaca College, and I have had the pleasure of taking a few classes with Dr. B, and she's a great educator. And I've always heard little tidbits of her story, of her being like, oh, I was a librarian at one point, and then obviously she became a doctor at another point. So I was just sitting in class and I was like, I need to know more about Dr. B. And I have been lucky enough to kind of be mentored by Dr. B and just find, you know, a safe space, especially for women in media, with Dr. B. So when these two worlds were colliding, I was like, Dr. B is the first person I want to invite on Paths to Purpose. And I'm so excited for you all to learn more about her journey and just hear everything that she has to say, because if anybody's gone through the process, it's been Dr. B.
Amazing. Well, we are super excited for our audience to hear her story. So without further ado, let's get into our interview with Dr. B. Dr. Lauren Britton Steele, PhD, is an assistant professor of television and digital media production and emerging media in the Park School of Communications at Ithaca College. She earned her PhD in information science and technology from Syracuse University. Her research lies at the intersection of human-computer interaction and social theory, with particular interest in feminist science and technology studies and ubiquitous computing. Lauren's dissertation explored the relationship between the human body and embedded or implanted technology. Prior to starting her PhD, Lauren worked as a public librarian where she designed and developed the first library makerspace. Lauren, welcome to Paths to Purpose, and thank you so much for joining us this week.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're really excited to hear more about your story. So maybe we could start with finding out more about the path that led you to getting a master's in library science, and then ultimately how you ended up at Syracuse getting your PhD.
Sure. So my undergraduate degree, I have a bachelor's degree in art history and cultural anthropology, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do after I'd finished my undergraduate degree, other than I wanted to live in New York City. That was kind of the focus at that time. And so I knew I wanted to go back to grad school eventually. I'd always wanted to be a librarian. And when I say always, I don't particularly remember the moment that that was a thing I knew I wanted to do. It was just kind of something that had always hovered in my mind. I think reading has always been a passion of mine. And the library always felt like this very magical place where you could walk in and take out as many books as you wanted for free. But I wasn't ready for that. I knew I was not ready for grad school. And so I moved to New York City and I worked there for a couple of years before I started taking evening classes. So after work, I would take, I think I took two or three classes in library science. So I didn't enroll in the master's degree, but I had started sort of taking one-off classes there. And it was offered through Long Island University, but the classes were taught at NYU in their library. So it was a really cool place to be. And after I dabbled in that, took a couple of classes, I decided to take the plunge, leave Manhattan, move back to Syracuse, and started the master's degree program there.
Can we talk about more of kind of how you decided being a librarian was something that you wanted to do? You said that you don't remember exactly when that moment was that you had that desire, but what about being a librarian was something that appealed to you that made you want to change trajectory while you were living in New York City, other than this idea that library was a magical place? And kind of where were you in your journey at that point?
I have a number of just really incredible memories from my childhood being in libraries. And so I think that played a part of the interest in wanting to go down that road. But then when I was in college, in my undergrad experience, I would spend a lot of time in the library. I didn't work there, but became friendly with a lot of the librarians and got to see what they did. And I was really interested in the ways that my undergraduate degrees, so sort of the art history, the cultural anthropology portions of that, were kind of tied into libraries with cultural heritage institutions and things like that. And so in the very beginning stages of my master's degree, I had thought I wanted to work at a museum or a special collections library. And in fact, I got a certificate in advanced study in cultural heritage preservation along the way during my master's. And I think it was more this idea that libraries are this place that, you know, it doesn't matter if you have money, it doesn't matter what kind of education you have had the privilege or not to have. And it was a place that it felt like a great equalizer of sorts, right? And that felt really powerful. And I met some really interesting people who were librarians along the way. And so I wish there was more of a like, aha, this is the thing and the reason that I knew I wanted to go and do that. But it was just more, it sort of felt like the next step. And I would have gone back earlier, but I'd had a couple of people along the way who talked me out of doing it. And I had listened kind of early on. And it felt almost a bit rebellious when I did decide to leave and go back and start the degree. But along the way, I had a shift where I decided, you know, the sort of special collections wasn't really what I wanted to do. And that happened. I was taking a class where it felt very non-traditional library stuff, right? We built TV beacons, which are these little devices that you can build that'll sort of scan through, and it's like a universal remote. And so it's tiny and it fits in a little box or something, and you can just go to a bar, for example, and it'll turn off all the television things. It was like learning about hacking systems and stuff that I didn't really knew it existed. And I learned about this concept of makerspaces in that class, not related to libraries in any way, but just, you know, here are places that people are hacking technology, messing with things. And it seemed to me like that is a natural progression, or at least an offering that should be included in libraries. Makerspaces at the time were really talked about as sort of, this was going to be like the next revolution, that it was going to democratize the means of production. And it was exciting, but I also realized how expensive most makerspaces were. You had to join, there were membership fees and things like that. And so it was very much, the maker movement at that time was very heavily dominated by white men with money. And I thought, wouldn't this be a great thing for a library, right? A public library to be able to offer this. Instead of, you know, having people check out books, you could check out machines or have a place that, you know, you had information professionals who could help guide the use of this technology. And you could have summer camps for girls to learn some of this stuff before society teaches them that math and science aren't for us and that kind of thing, you know? And I was lucky enough that I was given the opportunity to do this, to build this space. And the first library, public library makerspace was at the Fayetteville Free Library, right outside of Syracuse, New York. And yeah, so it was an exciting time.
Could you maybe back up a little bit and tell us what a makerspace is, if our listeners don't know, and kind of describe what that encompasses and why it's so exciting and important?
Yeah, so a makerspace, there's not one set thing that it is, but essentially it's really about a place that has access to things like 3D printers, laser cutters, all sorts of different technologies that used to be very much, you could only find at a university or some type of lab setting. And so it's a place that theoretically you should be able to go and you could make anything that you wanted in real time, manufacture it, have it, test out ideas, prototype, that kind of thing.
So Lauren, thanks for sharing the story. I wanted to follow up on this piece because we've heard a lot about kind of your journey, but you talked about advice and particularly bad advice. So along your path, how did you solicit advice, at what points, from whom, how did you filter whether the advice was healthy or not healthy? Because that's a common theme when people are doing career search.
Oh gosh. A lot of people offer advice, whether you ask or not. And I think a lesson that's been hard for me to learn along the way is what advice to filter out. I'm still not totally good at that yet, but there are a lot of people who want to tell you what to do. And it was difficult for me to push back, I think, against some of that advice, even if what was being said didn't really resonate with me or it felt like that's not really the right path. So I think learning the people to go to and to ask advice, knowing you might not like the answer and that you still need to make your own choice, has been an important thing for me to learn. So even if someone that you really respect and admire and you ask for advice and it doesn't necessarily kind of speak to your truth, that that's okay. I had a lot of people directing me, I think, and it for a long time, and learning to sort of stand on my own two feet and trust my own instincts was a challenge. And it's something I certainly still work on.
One of the things that we do talk about a lot is introspective work and kind of that process of getting to know yourself better. And that's not necessarily something that's trained in young people. And it's a process that we learn by a variety of different means. And so would love to hear more about kind of what your process is and how do you listen to yourself? Do you have trouble listening to your gut, or just how do you get to know yourself when considering really important life decisions like this?
I think there has been a process of learning to trust my instincts. I think particularly with young women, we're taught from a very young age in so many different ways to sort of make yourself as small as possible. Don't challenge authority. Don't be unpleasant. All sorts of things, right? And through that sort of process, your ability to trust yourself kind of goes away, right? That those gut feelings become something that don't feel safe to follow through on. And it's taken me a long time to sort of reconnect with that and understand, you know, that seeking external sources of direction at all times is not always the way to go, right? Needing approval, that it's okay to disappoint people. So for me, I think it's been sort of cultivating that feeling, right? That if there's an opportunity and I have, and this sounds very basic maybe, but like just a feeling like inside, like this does not, I don't want to do this, that it's okay to say no, right? To trust that feeling, that there's a reason that that's there. Or if there's something that seems really exciting, allowing yourself the opportunity to go for it and knowing that failure can happen and that that's okay, that it is okay to fail and it's okay to make mistakes. And you know, as long as you work hard and really try your best, that's it's a meaningful learning opportunity either way, I guess.
Thank you for sharing that. That's actually a core theme to what we're trying to communicate to our audience here. And I know that some of your research relates to social media and how people utilize social media for things like this. I was interested to hear your perspective on where social media fits in on influencing choices like this. Is it healthy? Does it hurt people who are trying to find themselves? Do you have a sense for how social media factors into this and the expectations upon us as young adults?
The research that I've done with social media has been very much around kind of motherhood stuff. So as far as young people making choices and decisions, it's not totally in my wheelhouse. But I do know from my own experience, I didn't delete my social media accounts, but I removed the apps from my phones. My phone had one phone, not plural. And I very mindfully will make choices to go on it or not, which might seem strange given that my research is in human-computer interaction and I study these things. But it was becoming a really mindless activity. It was taking so much time out of my day. And I think a lot of unhealthy thoughts and behaviors can come from constantly seeing everyone's best lives or whatever we want to say, right? Knowing that like I'm not posting the real stuff and I know that other people are not, right? We all want to put our best selves out there on social media, but it can be kind of a toxic thing at points. And so that was probably one of the healthiest things I ever did for myself. And I think I'm 2 years into that. And I, you know, go on Facebook maybe once every 2 weeks, Instagram, even less than that. And so I have to make an active choice to go on and do it. And I think social media can be a great thing, but it needs to be something that you engage with intentionally. And I think so many of us do not do that.
I think following up with that and also the last point that you made about just the way that women are socialized, I feel like there's so many things tied together in that with the social media space too, of just how particularly women, and we're talking about in this instance, are supposed to feel, to act, to look, to behave. And I'm wondering if I've definitely felt this myself, but in relation to kind of the work that you do in this space, have you felt imposter syndrome doing this work and also seeing this like juxtaposition of your research and your meaningful, you know, looking at motherhood and all these things mixed with this other side of social media and technology, and then also being a leader in this space. So I don't know if that's a very clear question, but I would love to just kind of learn more about kind of your mental space with engaging with these really difficult topics.
Yeah. So imposter syndrome, I think, yes, I have felt it. And I remember when I was during my PhD program, I was a member of Women in STEM Future Professoriate Program. And there was a holiday party and they had a door prize. And the prize, because I won it, which was very exciting, was a book about imposter syndrome written by, you know, some really incredible women and talking about their sort of experiences. And it was the first time I think that I'd thought with any depth about that term when I saw that book and what it actually meant, and had the opportunity to reflect on how often I felt that way throughout my life. I guess this idea that second guessing yourself or your ideas, is it a wise choice for me to speak up in this meeting? How is it going to impact me later? All of those choices that I feel like particularly women are constantly making, because there are some significant things that happen if you make the wrong choice, right? And trying like to plan 5 steps ahead, which is impossible, right?
The other thing that I'm thinking about as we're talking about this is, obviously you are a professor, you work with young people a lot. How do you see imposter syndrome playing out in the classroom space and with young people and how they're showing up every day?
I see it a lot in my classes when people are afraid to speak, afraid to get something wrong. And I try to structure my classes in a way that they are discussion focused, and finding ways to encourage people to say something and not to be afraid if they make a mistake. So for example, even if someone says something incredibly wacky, out of left field, not at all right, not the answer, instead of being like, that's not correct, I'll say like, oh, that's interesting. You're not quite there, right? Who can build on this or something, right? And so I've developed a lot of very intentional strategies to try to create a space that people feel comfortable saying something wrong, because wrestling with big ideas and complicated material, no one's going to get it right. I don't get it right all of the time. And I think that fear of failure, of not being enough, or embarrassing yourself in some way if you don't have all the right answers, is really problematic, right? Because we all fail and we all make mistakes, and that's okay. And trying to help students understand that and give them the freedom to express complicated thoughts without judgment, I think it's an important process that I don't think students often enough have the opportunity to do, right? Because so much of college is about, well, and all of their educational experience is like, don't fail, don't screw up. Because in you know, high school, it's you got to get into a good college and you don't want something on your permanent record. And what the hell is a permanent record anyways? It doesn't go with you to college and you have to have straight A's. And if you don't, like, I remember I got a B once and you would have thought, whew, it was not, I was disappointed in myself, and why didn't you get an A? And we teach kids that the grade is what's important, not the knowledge that you're getting along the way. And so, you know, we're going to study for the test rather than learn some critical thinking skills. And how can I incorporate this into the larger world around me? And I don't think we give as students enough opportunity to sort of grow in those ways, I guess. And so I do what I can to try to create those opportunities.
On a related note, do you get a sense that students come in with a heavy financial insecurity burden and that the entire purpose is to get a job that pays well? I mean, is that something that you see in your classroom? Because I sense it. And if so, what can we do to help them through that?
I think that that's sort of a bigger cultural thing. I mean, I felt lucky that I went to a small liberal arts college where the point was to get a liberal arts education. And, you know, I started as a ballet major and I was not at an institute of any kind, right? I wasn't going to be taking that major and going anywhere and doing something in the dance world with it. And my parents were supportive and they're like, you know, because you're getting this sort of well-rounded education. So whatever sort of strikes your passion is okay. Thankfully, I did not continue down that path because I don't know if I'd be where I am today. But I think this idea that everyone needs to be the next entrepreneur, right? Everyone needs to be the next influencer, that a liberal arts education isn't of value, that, you know, you need the business degree or the professional program, and you have to know in that kind of model what you want to do right from the beginning, which I find most students of that age don't know what they want to do. I mean, there are certainly exceptions to that rule, but I think the opportunity to sort of explore the world and college is one of the first times that a lot of people are exposed to sort of new ideas and, you know, an opportunity to sort of break down your worldview and rebuild it in a way that is independent potentially of your family of origin, and sort of you can start to understand the world in a different way. And so I think all of this pressure that we put on students to know what they want to do, that the most important thing is getting a job that makes a lot of money right off the bat, can be a disservice. I mean, we all need to make a living, and that's part of the capitalist system that we all have to exist in. And so and the cost of student loans, I think, plays into this and all of that, you know. But I think the opportunity to explore and figure out what you really want to do is important. And I don't think there's a lot of freedom to do that.
Yeah, I think I relate to that a lot. And I think that's why we're here talking about this today, is to kind of shed some light on that. Following that up, one of the things that we talk a lot about is mental health and just making sure that you take care of your whole self. And that includes your mind, your body, everything in between. Do you have any techniques or tips that you use in your life to make sure that you're kind of staying balanced and staying connected to your mind and just making sure that you are in a, if not a healthy mental space, just one that you're improving and you're trying to keep yourself balanced?
So I think not being afraid to talk about mental health is a big part of it, that it's okay to let people know that you're having a hard time, and it doesn't make you a weak person. It doesn't mean that you are not capable at your job or whatever the case is. So number one, and that's, I think, as a society, we need to do more work in making those things okay. But having these kinds of conversations help. I think developing a support system, because all of us have bad times, right? And having people that you can trust to talk to about your problems, whether that's a therapist, whether that's friends, family, people that you can be just your authentic self with, even when that authentic self is like in an Eeyore moment, and that's okay, right? So I've been very lucky to have found some incredible people who can sort of be that for me. Yoga and meditation have been incredibly important to me over the years. And I've fallen in and out of a regular practice with time and children and work, but I always can tell when I need to get back to it, because I reach a point of just like frenetic energy. I'm not sleeping. And I think for me, and a lot of women, and I'm speaking from my experience as a mother, right, that my needs are frequently the ones that are the last to be met, right? Because I work, and that is important. And so my students and teaching and research, that has to be a priority. And my kiddos, right? They have needs, and it's my job, and I love to do that, you know. But if it's my kid needs to do something, or I've got 20 minutes to do yoga, it's without a thought sometimes, of course, I'm going to knock the thing I need out of the way. And so finding a way to create balance is never easy. I think it's a myth. Truthfully, our society is not designed for people to have balance. And so you have to, again, be really intentional about it. At this point in my life, with three small kiddos and a full-time job, I get up at 4:15 in the morning every day and do yoga and meditation, because it's the only time that I'm going to have. And so I've learned to love it, but it's not always easy. And I was seeing a therapist for a while, and I wasn't sleeping, even though I was doing the yoga and all this. And she said, well, you know, sleep is the number one most important thing for your mental health. The next thing is water. The next thing is food. And she's like, so if you got all of those things in, then getting up at 4:15 in the morning is fine. But if you're already running on empty, getting up and doing yoga is not going to necessarily help you. You probably need the sleep more. And so part of this process has been learning, like, okay, today I need the yoga. That's what I'm going to do. And the next day, it's not lazy if I want to sleep in until 6 when the kids get up. That's okay. That's what I need today. And finding ways to be intentional with my time. It's not selfish to say, nope, I need to go do something. I can't read you a book right now because I'm going to lose my mind and I need to focus on myself. So I don't know if there's like a easy answer to that, but I don't even know if I've answered your question, but...
No, you definitely have. I'm going to actually ask you, if you don't mind, a question that's sort of a derivative to what I typically ask when we do career counseling to try to find a sense of self. And the question we normally ask is, if you could meet anybody in the world to speak to and have a conversation for an hour, whom would you choose and what would you ask? And then I'm noticing Ruth Bader Ginsburg behind you.
Yes.
I'm wondering what her influence is on you. So I didn't want to anchor you to her, but I just noticed that.
Yeah.
I know the audience can't see that. If it's not Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I'd be curious to hear your answer to the first question. And then I'm curious about the influence Ruth Bader Ginsburg has had on you.
It would be, actually. It would be her. Yeah, this was a gift from my husband a couple years ago. If I had the opportunity to have a conversation with her, I would just, you know, I've read books about her, I've watched movies about her, but the path that she sort of forged and the opportunities that I think were created because of the work that she did for women, I would just love to know more about her experience. We hear a lot about the incredible things that she's done. And in some of those movies and books, you hear about the hard things, but I would love to know, like, what was it really like in those moments when you're like, I don't think I can do this anymore? Or when you had just a horrible interaction with a colleague and it was very much tied to your gender and your experience as a woman and a mother in a very male-dominated space. Like, how did you internally, like, deal with that, right? And still move forward in such an incredible way. I think we tend to focus so much on like the positive things. So we know so many of the wonderful things that RBG did, but those moments of struggle, those that women frequently don't talk about, and how do you get through that and still do the work that you did, right? I think I would love to know those kinds of things, right?
That's honestly one of the reasons we're doing this podcast. Danielle actually had said this in an earlier taping where part of this is about the journey and about the struggle in the journey, not so much the destination. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the why this started, is sharing those vulnerable moments instead of just the accomplishments and kind of what you spoke to earlier about social media being a highlight reel. I think we're used to people talking about, you know, their careers or their personal life in the best moments and not in the bad ones or the ones that are just so confusing and tumultuous. And so I think that's really isolating if you're going through a time that is really hard and you just feel like the only thing that people want to share or hear about or pay attention to is the good stuff. So I think that that's incredible. And that speaks to kind of why we want to do this work. And I also have a poster of RBG. You can't see it, but in my office here too. I also am very inspired by her life and the things that she did. And especially being a law student, she's just phenomenal and her dissents are wonderful. But we kind of wanted to wrap up there. And just to finalize, what resources or any kind of recommendations would you like to share for our audience or for our young people? Any kind of, you know, books, documentaries, movies, anything that you've felt along this topic of focusing on finding who you are, your path, or maybe even interesting things that you've been reading or watching or listening to that they could add to their queue?
So one author, a poet actually, that I return to often when things are hard or whatever and life is difficult or I'm feeling uncertain about the direction forward or whatever the case is, her name is Amanda Lovelace. And my favorite book of poems that she wrote is called The Witch Doesn't Burn in this one. And it's really sort of about the ways that women need to become resilient and sort of the causes of why does that resiliency need to exist in the first place. But the path forward of how we can take control sort of our own experience, and that it's okay to name these experiences that we've had. And it's a really powerful book, and I love it, and all of her stuff is great. So I highly recommend that. I actually found it during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings when I was really struggling listening to all of that stuff that was going on. And I found this, it was recommended to me. And so highly recommend that. And then the other, I don't know if it's directly tied to this, but I've been reading a book, it's called Data Feminism by Catherine D'Ignazio and Lauren Klein. And I found it as part of some research that I was doing and a class that I had just started teaching on race, gender, and digital technologies. But it's been a really incredible way to see the way, or to understand the power of data and technology to either oppress or be a source, site of resilience. I don't know. It was very eye-opening to read, and I think it's a phenomenal book, and it's got lots of great charts and pictures, and it's accessible. I think a lot of times some of these texts are written in a way that's, unless you speak that language of academia, can be tricky. But I would highly recommend it if it's something people are interested in.
I'm going to add both of those to my list. thank you so much for joining us today. Is there any websites or anything that you want to share with our listeners of where they can find your work and your scholarship?
Google Scholar probably has most of it there. I need to update my IC profile, so I will add some stuff there. But those are probably the two places to go.
Well, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your story with our audience this week. And it was lovely getting to meet you and just to learn more about this amazing journey that you've been on so far. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. This episode was made possible by our audio engineer, Jack Booth, and our growth strategist, Mikey Lulo. For more resources and inspiration on finding your purpose, check out our Instagram @PathsToPurposePod. We'll see you next time. Bye.